place and growing up.
I really wanted to put on the page the Bushwick that I knew in the 70s, and that's the truth. So that's a biography of Bushwick. So everything that happened from the blackout to, you know, to what was happening in Biafra, to what was happening with Vietnam, to what was happening with the Son of Sam murders, all of that is true. And all of the stuff that was happening inside the neighborhood is true. So it's this narrative, this novel built around this biography. And because I also love poetry and I pay a lot of attention to the language, on top of that is this way of writing that really pays attention to the language, hence why it's so lyrical. And also because memory comes to us in this lyrical form.
That's Jacqueline Woodson talking about her novel An Other Brooklyn. It was just longlisted for the National Book Award. Then a novel about dependence and getting free.
Children have to learn to be dependent in order to learn about love. So in a way, Sophia just hasn't learned very much about dependence. She's learned quite a lot about independence. And that's a theme that runs through the book. And what do you do with the need to be, what does she do with her need to actually be nurtured?
That's Deborah Levy. Her novel, Hot Milk, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize this year. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Brianna. Jacqueline Woodson is a poet, and it shows in her moving new novel, Another Brooklyn. Edwidge Danticat called it another kind of book, another kind of beautiful, a lyrical, hallucinatory, heartbreaking, and powerful novel. Another Brooklyn is in the form of memoir, a woman looking back at her coming of age in a black neighborhood, Bushwick, in 1970s Brooklyn. The novel explores the memory of place as well as person. The Bushwick of the novel is in the midst of transition and crisis, as is its protagonist, August. Yet it also shows the depth and resiliency of both the neighborhood and the young girls growing into women who inhabit it. Jacqueline Woodson writes mostly for young readers, but Another Brooklyn is her second novel for adults. She's the 2014 National Book Award winner for Young People's Literature for her New York Times bestselling memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming. The Poetry Foundation named her the Young People's Poet Laureate. A multiple Newbery Award winner, she's the author of more than 24 books for young adults, middle graders, and children, as is its protagonist, August. Well, Jacqueline Woodson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
I loved this book, Another Brooklyn. It's both lyrical and very moving at the same time, also about a place that I know pretty well, Bedford-Stuyvesant, as my family lives there. Your protagonist is a young girl named August, and the time is the 1970s. Tell us a little bit about August before we go more deeply into her story, and a little bit about the Brooklyn that she comes to, because she's not from there originally.
No, she comes from Tennessee to a section in Brooklyn called Bushwick that in the 70s was at the edge of white flight. And she comes into the neighborhood kind of actually very isolated. She moves there with her brother and her father, and her father is very protective of them, so she's not allowed to leave the apartment they live in for a long time because he talks of the neighborhood not being safe. And it's from that point of view that she begins to take in her new surroundings and kind of come of age, and then eventually he gets braver and lets them move further than the apartment.
Now, this is so funny. I think I read this whole book thinking that this was Bedford-Stuyvesant.
That's funny.
And it's Bushwick.
It's Bushwick to the bone.
Yeah.
You know, separated by Broadway. Bushwick and Bed-Stuy are separated by the street Broadway, which was looted during the 1977 blackouts.
Oh, that's right. Well, I think that's just a testament to how personally I became involved in your story.
Great.
So, yes, yeah, so she comes from elsewhere. She, in fact, comes from Tennessee. Tell us a little bit about the circumstances that brought her, her father, and her brother to Bushwick.
Well, they come to Bushwick because this is where her father grew up, and they come after August's uncle has been killed in Vietnam, and as a result of him dying, her mother slowly begins to unravel. The uncle was the mother's brother. And so they end up leaving this land that had belonged to the mother's family. One reason is because the family slowly loses the land because of not knowing how to work it, because of not paying taxes, and a number of reasons. So they come from this place of unraveling. And the father's hope is that in Bushwick, he'll be able to raise a family and have a more stable life for himself and his kids, which, of course, was inspired by the Great Migration and the fact that so many people of color left the South between the early 1900s and the late 1970s for better opportunities in the North.
And there's a tragic sense, a thread, that runs through this book. And on the very first page, in fact, August says, I know that what is tragic isn't the moment, it's the memory. What is the tragedy that we begin this book with?
We begin the book with the tragedy of August not coming to terms with what really happened to her mother.
We do know that her mother dies because she does say, for a long time, my mother
wasn't dead yet.
So there is a sense of not a sudden event, but a lingering tragedy.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's the threat of death that weaves itself through the narrative because August grows up to be an anthropologist studying the rituals of death and dying. And we also learn that she's coming to terms with immediate death in her own family, the deaths of that are happening in Brooklyn that she's bearing witness to, and then even the small death of what happens when one goes from being a young child to being an adult or a young adult.
Right. As I mentioned just before, she says, I know that what is tragic isn't the moment, it's the memory. This is a novel in the form of a memoir. And you wrote a memoir prior to this also, a memoir for young people, I suppose, Brown Girl Dreaming, which won the National Book Award. I wonder if you could talk about memoir, you know, how you approach memoir, both in this book and in the previous one.
Well, in Another Brooklyn, one thing that August says again and again is, this is memory. And basically she's saying this is memory as a way to say this is mine, this is what belongs to me, no one can take what I remember away. And when I was writing Brown Girl Dreaming, it is a memoir, so it is my memory. It's my experience of my childhood. And it was kind of important for me to put that narrative on the page in form of memory. So it's on the page in verse because memory comes to us in these small moments with all of this white space around it, all these places of unknowing or unremembering. And so I wanted to get that on the page. And then as I also wanted to remember Bushwick, because in the writing of Brown Girl Dreaming, the many years of writing that, the years before and after, my mom had died, and I ended up getting the house that I grew up in Bushwick and bearing witness to how the neighborhood was so quickly changing and how it was becoming this neighborhood that was, quote-unquote, discovered. And I really wanted people to remember that this was a neighborhood that real people lived in, that people who thrived were living in, that people who had dreams and wishes were living in, that it wasn't a neighborhood that young white people moved to and suddenly it existed. And so it was. I think memory is so important because I think we live in a society where we'd rather forget the stuff that makes us uncomfortable. And one thing about Bushwick is the reason that it changed, the reason it changed the first time was because of white flight. Mm-hmm. And people, black and Latino people were moving in And white folks were saying, we don't want to live around black and Latino people. They're going to bring our neighborhood down. So they moved out to Long Island. They moved to Queens. They moved to Westchester. And then this wave of what happened to Bushwick in the 90s and presently is young white folks moved in and discovered it as a place with cheap rents and an artist community. And that, you know, wow, it's safe, actually. And the neighborhood began changing again. And so I really wanted to put on the page the Bushwick that I knew in the 70s, and that's the truth. So that's a biography of Bushwick. So everything that happened from the blackout to, you know, to what was happening in Biafra, to what was happening with Vietnam, to what was happening with the Son of Sam murders, all of that is true. And all of the stuff that was happening inside the neighborhood is true. So it's this narrative, this novel built around this biography. And because I also love poetry and I pay a lot of attention to the language, on top of that is this way of writing that really pays attention to the language, hence why it's so lyrical. And also because memory comes to us in this lyrical form.
Well, yes, that's what really struck me. I mean, it's almost like a prose poem, and it is in that poetry and the lyricism of the language that memory is evoked. I mean, that's what makes it so evocative. I almost wonder that's why. And now I remember it was Bushwick in the beginning. I remember that, and I remember being surprised, and then I just completely supplanted that.
That's fabulous.
Because what you're talking about is something I have seen. I mean, my son is white and his wife is Japanese, and they were really the first non-African-American people on their block, and his wife had been there, you know, before any white folks moved into Bedford-Stuyvesant, which was one of the most vibrant, probably one of the most vibrant black communities in the United States. I think people usually think of Harlem, but really Bedford-Stuyvesant was and is. I shouldn't say past, but just in the later than Bushwick, just in the last 2 years, I've seen a real transformation. And I'm always struck by what is going to happen to the culture. People are being pushed out. Where are they going? What is going to happen to this amazing community?
And will it be remembered? That's the thing, too, right? I mean, even looking at Park Slope, where we're a mixed-race family, but we're the only family of color on our block. And there was a time when you look at something like Pauli Marshall's Brown Girl, Brown Stones, these, you know, there was a period where Caribbean people came to this area, they bought homes, you know, they had plans of, you know, nesting here, and then that in the 70s, they were offered cash for their homes. Some of them cashed out and moved back to their country. Some of them got pushed out. And just like that, the neighborhood became a different neighborhood. Even my block, which was Italian and Irish, like first generation, old school Brooklynites, and they either died off or they got older, their family sold their houses, and then younger, wealthier white folks moved in. For me, that really, I love Brooklyn so much, and really just kind of chronicling the history of a place so that people just remember that people lived here. And what you said about Bed-Stuy was a much more affluent neighborhood than Bushwick at the time. So it was brownstones. The houses were much more solid because Bushwick were the houses, for the most part, were wood frame structures. Wooden brick, whereas Bed-Stuy was brick. And but Bushwick had a lot of fires, and it was kind of a place that people didn't want to move to because it didn't feel as stable as someplace like Bed-Stuy. So as a result, the African-American community in Bed-Stuy had these beautiful homes that increased in value and that they stayed in for generations. And then as they started dying off again, you know, their kids either sold their homes or the ones who, I was just listening to a story about a woman who rented from owners for, I don't know, something like 30 years, and then the owners died, and now she's getting pushed out because the kids are selling the home. And you just hear these stories again and again where people are taking care of each other by renting to people that look like them. Park Slope, before I bought a home, it was nearly impossible to find a rental because no one wanted to rent to an African-American, you know, and that kind of, you just look at the history of real estate in New York City, and it's kind of devastating, and it's kind of fascinating. But Bushwick, I feel like it can very easily get erased. Its history could get erased because not a lot of people are writing it down. So Another Brooklyn, as you know, it opens with me saying, for Bushwick, 1970 to 1990, in memory.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jacqueline Woodson about her new novel, Another Brooklyn. It's also, as you said, a story of a young girl who becomes a young woman during the course of it, and also during the course of it breaks out of the isolation with which she first comes to Bushwick. She comes with her father and brother from another place. Her father works all day and, you know, locks the kids up, basically tells them not to leave the house. And yet she is ultimately able to break out of that isolation into a group of girls. Tell us about this wonderful group of friends.
Mm-hmm. So August first sees the three girls, Sylvia, Angela, and Gigi, from her high-up window where she's like Rapunzel and is envious of them, is kind of falling in love with them because they seem so free and they seem so connected and they just seem to have each other. And she's, again, pretty isolated. Eventually, as her father feels more comfortable and allows August and her brother to move out into the world, she befriends the girls, and the four of them become kind of this human shield for each other and become really intimate. And I really wanted to explore that because I feel like I have this village and it's the people that are helping us raise our kids and who we have dinner with every Sunday and who are just there for us no matter what. And I couldn't imagine a world without the strong women in my life. And I've seen adult women who don't have women friends, and I've always kind of thought, how did that ever happen? Mm-hmm. And so I really wanted to start with girl friendships because I think they are so intense and important and help us become who we're becoming. So August befriends these four girls, and the four of them have this really intense friendship for many years.
And the girls themselves, they embody differences of class, you know, even some extremes.
Culture.
Yeah, class and culture. Talk a little bit about Sylvia, Angela, and Gigi.
So they are, Sylvia's family comes from Martinique and is a very upwardly mobile family. Her father has dreams of all of his kids being college graduates. He spouts French philosophers, and they, you know, are learning all things upwardly mobile, from what side of, you know, where to place your fork at dinner and your dessert fork at dinner, to where to how to play the piano, to speaking other languages, and the whole dream for him is this dream of higher education for his daughters and opportunity and a professional life. And then we have Angela, who has this kind of secretive life, who dances beautifully, who dreams of being a dancer, but who keeps her home life very hidden, and we eventually find out why. And then we have Gigi, who's the child of a teenage mother, and whose mother is pushing her toward acting, and Gigi herself is an amazing actor and is aspiring toward that, and eventually leaves the neighborhood to go to this performing arts school. And then we have August, who's at once the watcher and also very much engaged with these girls, who has her own dreams of a professional life, but as she says in the book, no one looked at her and saw that as her future. So she aspires to basically have Gigi's life, and at once is envious of it and adoring of it. And eventually, August is one of the two girls who kind of, quote-unquote, makes it.
Are these girls drawn from girls that you knew growing up?
You know, I had my girls growing up, and I still have my girls. I think they are, I always say there's Jacqueline Woodson in every single character. And I think with Another Brooklyn, There are so many ways one's life can go, and so much of it is, you know, happenstance. So much of it is luck. I you know, with me, I've written, 32 books. I've won just about every award there is to win. You know, people refer to me as brilliant. And all I keep thinking is, you throw a stone and you hit 20 of me. But I was lucky enough to, you know, get recognized. I was lucky enough to have a publishing opportunity. I was lucky enough to get my voice in the world. And not to say that I'm not disciplined and not ferociously connected to my writing, but at the same time, I don't think I'm outstanding. I think so that was one of the things I was exploring in Another Brooklyn is we all have this potential to get out and thrive in the world, but then there's circumstance, then things happen. Maybe someone gets pregnant. Maybe someone's mother is not there to help them get into the high school they need to get into. Maybe someone ends up in foster care. You know, we just have no control over so much of our lives as young people. And so those, I had good friends. Things like that did not happen to my friends, thankfully. But I knew kids who were in foster care. I knew girls peripherally who got pregnant. I knew kids who ended up dropping out of high school. Like, so all of that was a part of the Bushwick I knew. And of those young people, so many of them were and are so brilliant. And it's interesting because I was having lunch with my ex-boyfriend from high school, who's one of my closest friends in the world. And we have a group of friends, and it's like 10 of us. And it's actually like 15 of us, but we were the college-bound kids, right? We were the kids who got paid special attention to because we got good grades, and we were noticed in this way. And now he's the head of PSAL in New York City. But even that is because our guidance counselor adored him and worked for the Board of Ed and helped him, you know. And so, so I think it is about opportunity, it is about luck, and it is about perseverance. But it kind of breaks my heart that so many young people don't get the opportunity because of their circumstances. So that's how I'm connected to those girls.
And that's a great story, and that puts me in mind of a book, though by way of contrast, unfortunately, whose author we interviewed several months ago, Monique Morris's book, Push Out, which really chronicles how Black girls are increasingly pushed out of school, pushed into the prison pipeline, you know, and the stories in the book show the incredible resilience, strength, resistance that so many young Black girls in high school, let's say, or even younger, exert against what's happening to them, but the inevitable undertow of so much that's stacked against them.
Oh, I have to read that. I'm so glad you mentioned that book. And I love the word undertow because that's exactly what it is. And that's for me, who's not a swimmer.
even worse then.
Yeah.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jacqueline Woodson about her new novel, Another Brooklyn. So now, your books have mostly been for young readers, and this one is it the first one for adults?
No, I wrote another one in 1995 called Autobiography of a Family Photo, and it was interesting because I had written a number of novels for middle graders and young adults, and then I thought, it's so interesting because people are always asking, when you write for young people, do you ever plan to write for adults? Whereas no one asks writers of adult fiction, do you ever plan to write for young people? So I think that's just another way that our society is skewed against young people. But I felt like, okay, I did it. I wrote an adult novel, and what I really love is writing for young people. I love filling that gap where so many books are not there about people who look like me, so many books where young people can see reflections of themselves in the literature. And so I I went back to writing for young people and loving it. And then I felt like after Brown Girl Dreaming won the National Book Award, I was already writing notes down for Another Brooklyn. I didn't know what it was going to be, and I was thinking about Bushwick and researching Bushwick. I was also researching Rituals of Death and Dying. And again, I didn't know what this was going to become, but when Brown Girl Dreaming won the National Book Award, I said, I think I want to step back. I want to do something completely different. I want to play with time in a different way. I want to write from an adult perspective, and I want to write from the perspective of an adult looking back on girlhood. And so it started falling into place, but I really wanted to talk about memory and place, and I really wanted to put Bushwick on the page.
And when you say talk about time, say more about that, because that's another, you know, this book, we often think of memoir as something that's just talking about the past. Of course, through the lens of the present, but that isn't always obvious. In this case, it is. You're moving back and forth between the past and the present.
Mm-hmm. That's a great thing about adult literature, is you can play with time in that way. When you're writing for young people, you're in the moment of their lives. So you're 15, mm-hmm. or you're 10, or you're 19. But you're not... You're not moving forward into an adult perspective because they don't have that. And with Another Brooklyn, because of how memory works, you do move through time differently. And so I play with that a lot in the book. You know, she's in the past, she's in the present, she's talking about a future. And because it's poetic and because it's a non-linear narrative and because of how I use white space, the reader can follow me or have faith that I'm going to get them where they need to be.
Yeah, it's a stunning book. And are you working on something else?
Yeah. Right. You know, I just came back from, 2 months ago I was in Palestine, and so I'm writing an essay for a book that Michael Chabon and Ayelet Waldman are doing in response to the 50th year of the occupation. That's coming out next year. So my essay is due like 3 weeks ago. So I'm trying to get it done, and I can't think of anything beyond that right now. I am taking notes. I never know what the next book is going to be until I know, but I'm taking notes and thinking about stuff deeply in the meantime.
Is that how you work, that you just take, do you have a notebook that you take notes in, or just put it?
I wish I was that organized. I have a bunch of notebooks. Sometimes I write on my hand. I have sticky notes. I have, right now, I'm down in my office, and I'm looking at some of the notes that are on my wall. But I write them on whatever I have, and then I try to keep them together in an envelope or something so I could pull them all out. But everyone always gives writers notebooks and journals as presents, so I have a ton of them, and each probably has about 2 pages written in it. I just don't have the capacity to write in one for the duration.
Well, I actually have the same problem, I guess you could say. But it's because when something occurs to you, you're going to write it down with whatever is at hand. Otherwise, you're going to miss it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And they're just random notes, like any one of them could turn into a book, or any other of them could turn into a different book?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, Jacqueline Woodson, it's just been great to talk with you about this wonderful novel in the form of a memoir, Another Brooklyn. I look forward to talking with you again and to reading more of your books. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Oh, it's been great talking to you. Thanks so much.
Jacqueline Woodson. Another Brooklyn was named to the long list for this year's National Book Award. You can read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with Deborah Levy about Hot Milk. Stay tuned after the break.
If you knew that you would die today, you saw the face of God and love, would you change? Would you change? If you knew that love can't break your heart, when you're down so low you cannot fall, would you change? Would you change? How many losses, how much regret? What chain reaction would cause an effect? Makes you turn around, makes you try to explain, makes you forgive and forget, makes you change.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Mothers and fathers are supposed to take care of their kids, not the other way around, right? But that doesn't always happen. Deborah Levy's new novel, Hot Milk, explores the complicated push and pull of one of those mother-daughter relationships that are inverted. And it follows the process by which the daughter frees herself to take up her own life. Sophia, a young woman of 25, has brought her mother to a seaside town in southern Spain to find a cure for mom's puzzling limb paralysis. There, Sophia finds a dangerous love, a doctor who could be a brilliant healer or a quack, and ultimately she finds herself. Deborah Levy is a novelist, short story writer, and playwright. Hot Milk has been shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, as was a previous novel, Swimming Home. Deborah Levy, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hi, Francesca. Such a pleasure to be talking to you.
Now, this book is entitled Hot Milk, a little bit of a shocking title in some ways, and I'm not exactly sure why. So tell us about the title.
Well, I guess that there are a lot of queasy associations with hot milk. When we are ill and we're children and our mom thought that some warm milk might be soothing and calming, and then it had that skin on it, and then there are associations with maternal milk. And all of that, and I kind of wanted that slight uneasiness because part of the story is about a mother and daughter, but hot milk also refers to the galaxies, to the Milky Way, which also has a part to play in the story.
Yeah, so... You know, what I found so interesting about this story, apart from the resonance I felt with my own life, I have to say, is that it's not really a coming-of-age story as much as a coming into one's own story. And I wonder if you could talk about, you know, the difference. I mean, there is development that's going on here, like a coming-of-age story, but this person is much older than an adolescent.
Right.
The protagonist, Sophia.
Yeah, well, Sophia Papasteriadis has a number of problems. So if a character has no problems, there's really nothing to do as a writer. So I give her a surname that none of her school teachers can spell or pronounce. She's asked to write down the letters of her name every day when she was a kid. And the thing is that her father was Greek, but walked out of the family home when she was five, and her mother, Rose, was born in Yorkshire. So Sophia Papasteriadis has an identity in her name that's very hard for her to carry. And she has to figure that out. What's she going to do with that name, and how is she going to carry that name and all its baggage in the world? So that's the first thing. And then I guess the second thing is that I've set the book in the south of Spain in the European desert, so it's a very arid, big landscape. It's described in guidebooks as a lunar landscape. And Sophia feels very small in her own life, so I wanted somebody, a female protagonist, who feels a bit lost, not quite sure what she wants to do with her life, looking after her mother, who is sporadically ill. And I was interested in that idea of really making mistakes, being allowed to mess up, being allowed to think things through and digress and not just be totally driven by goals and outcomes. So that was all important in the writing of Sophia.
And this is something that in many ways she hasn't really had the freedom to do before this book begins. She's a woman who is in her 20s, is that right?
Yeah, right. She's just 25.
And she has really devoted her life to her mother so far. Tell us about the origins of that relationship between them.
Right. So her mother has limb paralysis. Sometimes her mother, who's only 64, can walk, and sometimes she's lame. And Sophia feels that she's been like a girl detective, sort of sleuthing her mother's symptoms since she was a child. And one of the themes in Hot Milk, and thus the title, is hypochondria, which really interests me. We all either are one or we have one in our family. You know, I was interested in the way we use illness and sickness as a way of controlling other people, perhaps, or of gathering love and attention to us. And so I make it ambiguous. Is Rose actually ill, or does she need attention that she's never had in her life? What actually is wrong with Mom is what Sophia asks herself. The writer James Baldwin, who I am a great fan of, had a very interesting thing to say. I kind of misquote him here, but it's something like, I believe that people who cling to their hates so stubbornly fear that once hate has left, they will be left with their pain. I thought that was a very smart quote, and I flipped it so that, you know, maybe we fear that once our symptoms have left, we will be left with our pain. So Hot Milk is also looking at what symptoms are saying, how they can do the talking for us. Symptoms, you know, do a lot of the chattering for stuff that's just too awkward to voice or too painful to voice. We all know how if we feel angry or undermined, we can get a headache or backache. So that kind of territory of the body doing the speaking for the characters is another theme in Hot Milk.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and you're listening to Writer's Voice. We're talking with Deborah Levy about her stunning new novel, Hot Milk. The mother, Rose, can't feel her feet. She cannot, mm-hmm. She cannot be grounded. But on the other hand, Sophia can't drive.
Yeah, that's right. She just flunked her driving test 4 times. And one of the things that she learns to do in the south of Spain is to drive. And very late in life. And she kind of becomes her mother's chauffeur. There was a lot of comedy that I could kind of get out of that situation. Sophia becomes bolder as the book develops. She falls in love. She She is an anthropologist. She is also unemployed. She doesn't know what to do with her anthropology degree. And her doctorate, she tells us, is on the subject of cultural memory. So really, Hot Milk, because it's told in the first person, it's Sophia speaking, is her anthropology. It is her gaze on what's happening, in her life. And she also sees her mother as a kind of anthropological study, that pain is there to be deciphered, explained, interrogated, as well as soothed. So Sophia puts her anthropology to use in Hot Milk.
And it's not just, her mother's not just, of course, an object of study, but is someone who, you could say that Sophia herself is an object of her own mm-hmm. study here.
Definitely.
She says that her mother had chosen to keep her daughter in her place, forever suspended between hope and despair. Could you explain what you mean by being suspended between hope and despair?
Well, hope in the sense that her mother will heal and get better, and despair in the sense that there's another day where even more mysterious and unfathomable symptoms are being presented by Rose. And so, Sophia says later, I wanted my mother to take, Sophia says later, I want my mother to take the voyage out of gloom, to be well, to be vital in the world. Susan Sontag wrote a very interesting play about Alice James, sister of Henry James. And she described Alice James, who was very smart, but with these incredible brothers, William and Henry, as a kind of career invalid. She takes to her bed and seems very reluctant to risk going out into the world and failing and triumphing, and that's what we all have to do. We have to take risks. And I guess Hot Milk is about that. It's about taking risks in love, in self-definition, in relationships, in parental relationships, in erotic relationships, and intellectually taking risks. And this all happens, as I said, in the south of Spain. The ocean is infested with jellyfish. And in Spain, jellyfish are called medusas. So there's also a kind of play in Hot Milk with mythology and with the myth of the Medusa, many different versions of this myth. But Medusa was a beautiful Greek young woman who was cursed by Athena, and her hair was turned into a tangle of writhing snakes. And Athena, who was the goddess of war, actually gave Medusa a very strangely useful curse too, which is that anyone who hurt her or looked at her in a way that undermined her, she could turn to stone. So I'm looking at that myth too in Hot Milk. The myth of the female gaze returned. And Sophia's gaze is both anthropological and just she's just also very confused. And I like that. I like writing for a character who really has to figure things out and isn't all-knowing. And at the end of the book, I give Rose, the mother, that gaze without any spoilers. She turns her gaze in a very different way from the beginning of the book to Sophia.
a resolution that is often, a satisfying resolution that is often not given to us in real life. What's so charming, I think, about this novel, so satisfying about this novel, is that one can watch the characters unfold, develop, and learn from their mistakes, you know, and even take joy in their mistakes. I mean, Sophia, you said she, you know, she takes some risks. One of these is that she falls in love with a woman who she says is not a safe person to love.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, she has to do that, a very kind of adolescent infatuation. But then we see the necessity of those kinds of infatuations.
Yeah, well, we all know that it would be better to fall in love with somebody who will reciprocate our own feelings and perhaps isn't as, what can we say about Ingrid Bauer? Ingrid Bauer is a seamstress. She takes in sewing for a vintage shop in the village. And she and Sophia become infatuated with each other. And I guess the book is chasing the theme that it's good to take risks, that we can die of safety. Mm-hmm. And Rose Papastergiadis, before she married her husband, was Rose Booth. She was born in a small village in Yorkshire, and she took a risk. She married out of her small community and learned a whole other language, etc. So this book really isn't about things being set in stone. It's much more a sort of homage to, well, trying things out, making mistakes, then trying not to mess up again. I think there can be more space for a world that isn't just about a multiple choice questionnaire with yes or no answers. This book is the opposite of that, really.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. We're talking with Deborah Levy about her stunning new novel, Hot Milk. And I wanted to ask you, too, you know, I think I said in the beginning that I felt a personal resonance. I mean, I had a mother who was well-known and a performer and a very, you know, an amazing human being to be in the life of, but also somebody who needed to be taken care of. That was a message mm-hmm. I got from a very early age. I think mm-hmm. by the age of 3, I already knew that was my job in life,
mm-hmm.
was to put her needs before mine. And both Rose's mother does that, but also her father does that. There's a point in the book where where she tells somebody, my father only does things that are to his advantage. And her father's very young wife, who's nearly Sophia's
age. The same age as Sophia, yeah.
Right, says, well, why wouldn't he do things that are not to his advantage? So I wonder if you could address this notion of duty and obligation on the one hand, and in all its, you know, human complexity, and taking care of oneself.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of the novel, it explores the rage of being asked to really care for someone who should be caring for you, for putting all your own needs and desires aside, canceling them, and giving your attention to the care of someone else. So the book is about duty, and the book is about desire. And there is also a lot of gratification in duty. But in terms of your experience with your mother, I think that Susan Sontag, again, was a big influence on me, because in her diary, she talks about that kind of relationship with her mom. And she says, it was as if I was the author of her happiness or her unhappiness. And children have to learn to be dependent in order to learn about love. So in a way, Sophia just hasn't learned very much about dependence. She's learned quite a lot about independence. And that's a theme that, runs through the book. And what do you do with the need to be, what does she do with her need to actually be nurtured and looked after? That's not to say that Rose Papastergiadis is two-dimensional in that sense, because she is actually very caring in her way of Sophia. But in the end, her needs are, she has placed her needs first. It's a case for Dr. Freud, Francesca.
She what?
It's a case for Dr. Freud, I think. Yeah.
Well, and that brings up the doctor in the book, who is another fascinating character that keeps the reader guessing. One doesn't know if he's a quack or a genius.
Yeah. I sort of based him on Freud a little bit, but made him more shamanic. I've always wanted to write a character like Dr. Gomez. So as you say, we don't know whether he's a quack or whether he's an incredibly rigorous physician. He's a consultant. He's there to diagnose Rose. They've traveled all this way to his clinic as their last hope. And his methods are not particularly conventional. He asks Rose to make a list of her enemies and her adversaries. He insists that she comes off all her medication. She has a long list of medication, and he says no, he won't treat her unless she comes off all of it. He regards this medication as a ritual that she has become addicted to. So really there is this tension of, is she going to be okay? Is he irresponsible? Does he know what he's doing? And the issue of trust when we put ourselves in the care of professionals. Yes, so that is Dr. Gomez. And he has a white cat called Jodo, who is a little like his familiar. Every time we see, we meet Dr. Gomez, he's always there with his white cat.
Now, I don't usually ask authors about their personal life, but, I've shared mine, so I'm going to ask you about yours. What was your relationship with your mother like?
Okay. My mother is not really anything like Rose in the book. Like us all, she did have her phases of aches and pains that were sort of mysterious and unfathomable. I do remember as a kid feeling a little bit like Rose, you know, I wonder what's really wrong with Mum, kind of thing. But on the whole, you know, my mother was a very distinguished, avid reader of books and a good talker. So she's not really like Rose. I guess what interests me about hypochondria as a subject is something the French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan said, which is that the hypochondriac is asking a question he or she doesn't want answered. So it's a bit like, we go to our doctor and we say we have headaches, and the doctor starts to ask us questions and to take notes. And that's called taking a narrative. So that's of great interest to a writer like myself, that phrase, you know, taking a narrative. And the hypochondriac, and that's all of us really in one way or another, not as extreme as Rose, but we all have it in us, doesn't really want a diagnosis, because any time the doctor gets near one, he or she presents another, even more mysterious and more sort of flamboyant symptom. So what is it that we don't want? Is it that we're asking? And what is it that we don't want to answer? You know, that's all there in Hot Milk too.
Yeah, and yet it's interesting because the hypochondriac, in a way, is creating a is creating connection or creating relationships or is, you know, that
trying to speak. Yep.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yep. Yeah. So it's a really very rich. It's a very rich subject, and some of that is in my novel. So Dr. Gomez has a daughter who is a nurse at his clinic, and she's called Nurse Sunshine because she never smiles. And she, in some ways, is modeled a little on Freud's daughter, Anna Freud, only very, very slightly. But I like this idea of this father-daughter team in the clinic, and in some ways, their message to Sophia is that she is using her mother's illness as a shield to protect her from her own life and from making a life.
Exactly. And, you know, so in a way, it's very much akin to her mother's hypochondria. And yet, she does then take her life boldly into her own hands.
Mm-hmm.
She says at one point, we have to mourn our dead, but we cannot let them take over our life. I found this a very moving book and a funny book at the same time. It was just wonderful to be able to talk with you about this here on Writer's Voice. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And how did you ever manage to make peace with your mom? Did you get over just feelings?
Yes. I mean, she was a lot of fun, too. So
yeah.
We were very close, but much too close. And it really
mm-hmm.
wasn't until she died that I started being able to put my own life first.
Mm-hmm.
But better late than ever.
I think that's very common. Yeah. Well, thank you for your great questions. And I'm so pleased that the book meant something to you.
Deborah Levy is a novelist, short story writer, and playwright. Hot Milk has been shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, as was a previous novel, Swimming Home. Read an excerpt from Hot Milk at writersvoice.net. Be sure to turn in next week when we delve into longevity and even immortality. We talk with theoretical biologist Josh Middledorf about his book, The New Science of Growing Old and What It Means for Staying Young. He co-authored it with ecological philosopher Dorian Sagan. Then Aaron Teer tells us about his novel, Mr. Eternity. It's a romp through time from the 1500s to the 2500s with an explorer named Daniel Defoe who cannot die. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.